I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice. Today, I have Denise Bennett in the studio with me. Denise is a storyteller, and we've invited her here to the Virginia Voice to talk a little bit about the fine art of storytelling, to tell us a little bit about her own experience, and to tell us a story. So welcome, Denise.
Thank you.
I've set out a tall order for you, but from everything that I hear, you'll be more than able to do all of that for us. First, your own story about becoming a storyteller. You are, by training, a theologian, correct?
Well, I have a Master's of Divinity degree from Union Theological Seminary. I'm not ordained. I'm a lay chaplain at the Hermitage United Methodist Home. So,
well,
wow.
We do have some wonderful listeners, so hi to all those folks at the Hermitage.
So I don't know if I'd consider myself a theologian, but that is really where I got my start, other than telling stories to my kids at home, telling while I was in seminary, using storytelling to preach was really where I started to take the stories beyond just my home.
Now, we are a radio reading service. We read stories, but there's a big difference between reading stories and telling stories. Could you talk a little bit about how you get from reading a story to telling a story?
Sure. When I first started telling stories, my initial impulse was to read a story and to memorize it, because that was what I did as an actress. I was a theater major in college. That was what made sense. But as I went on, I realized that people, when they told stories, even traditional stories like folk tales, they put their own spin on it. They didn't tell it the same way twice. And so I began to go to workshops, and I learned that rather than memorizing the words, storytelling was about seeing the pictures, or, well, some people see them. Other people are more kinesthetic, so maybe they feel the story in their body, or maybe they hear the story. But for me, it was seeing the story unfolding in my mind. And so while I might practice certain words because I like to turn a phrase and I like to use that each time I told the story, for the most part I wasn't memorizing anymore. I was just relaying the story as I was experiencing it unfolding inside me.
Do you have favorite stories that you love to tell?
I do. I do. There are some folk tales that I just adore, and then there are some stories that come from my own life that I really like to tell as well.
Will you tell us a story?
I certainly will. This is one that I worked on recently, and I don't really have a title for it yet, but it goes like this. I love to meet new people. I love to hear their stories, and I love to share my stories with them. But there's always one question that comes up that I dread, because I don't really know how to answer it, and that's, where are you from? My dad was in the Air Force, so we moved around a lot. Well, when I tell people this, they always try to be helpful, and they say, well, where were you born? But that doesn't solve the problem, because, well, I was born in the Netherlands, but I'm not Dutch. My parents are from Indiana and Missouri, but I'm not a Midwesterner. We lived in Tennessee and Virginia and Alabama twice, but I'm not a Southerner. I lived in New York, but I'm not a New Yorker. And I lived in Montana, but I'm not a cowgirl. I'm not really from anywhere. And it used to be that didn't bother me so much, but since I've become a storyteller, well, I go to these festivals, and I hear people tell these great stories about growing up in Brooklyn, or there's this storyteller who tells all these stories about growing up in the same little town in North Carolina, and he remembers all the details of all the colorful characters there. And, oh, I never lived anywhere longer than 4 years, my whole growing up time. And then there are people, when you go to festivals, they tell stories from their ethnic background. African stories or Native American stories. But if I were to tell stories from my ethnic background, well, which one would I do? Let's see, that would be English, French, German, Finnish, Swiss, Scottish, and those are just the ones I know. So I got really excited a couple of years ago when my mother started doing genealogy, and she said, I think that your great-great-great-grandfather Clements was born in Ireland. And I was thrilled because I love Irish everything. I love Irish music. I love Irish stories. I play the harp. That's the national symbol of Ireland. I was just thrilled. I'm Irish. I had an identity. It was so thrilling. And so when my husband asked me last year where I wanted to go for our 25th wedding anniversary, I didn't hesitate. I want to go to Ireland. When our plane touched down in Dublin, they didn't have one of those little tubes that connects the plane to the airport. And so you actually had to walk down the little stairs and across the tarmac. And as I got to the bottom of the stairs and my foot first touched the concrete, I actually thought about getting down and kissing the ground. But there was a big grease stain there, so I didn't do it. But then we were in Dublin, and the first place we went after we'd gotten over our jet lag was to Trinity College, and we saw the Book of Kells. This beautiful illustrated book, the four Gospels, and it had all that intricate knot work around the edges and the beautiful illustrations with the gold and these bright colors. And I thought to myself, my people, the Irish, when the rest of Europe was in the Dark Ages, my people were creating these beautiful works of art. We went on a walking tour of Dublin, and we heard the story about the Irish rebellion against the English, how they threw off the yoke of English oppression, and we heard the story of the Easter Rising, and I thought to myself, my people, the Irish, look at how much they loved freedom. Look at what they were willing to suffer to get it. We went across the country in our rented car to the West Coast, and one day we went out on a ferry to one of the Aran Islands. We went to the least touristy one, Inishmain, and there are really just a handful of people there and a lot more sheep and cows. But we were going up the lane, and it was a stone path, and as we were going up, this little man in a motorized wheelchair was coming back down, and of course, since he knew everybody on the island, he knew that we were tourists, so he stopped, and we began to talk, and he asked us about the United States and told us about his life. He was 89 years old, and then it was early April. It was still really cold, but there were things blooming. And he pointed to this tiny little white flower that was growing through a crack in the stone fence. And he said, do you see that? That's a Mayflower. I just took the first one to my wife yesterday. He said, you know, I don't believe in everything the church teaches. I have my doubts. But when you look at something like that, well, how can you not believe there's a God? And I thought to myself, my people, the Irish, why, even the common man on the street is a poet and a theologian. Well, our time was coming to an end, so we had to go back to Dublin. And on one of the last days that we were there, we went to the National Library because they have an extensive genealogy section. And we found out that my husband's family was also from Ireland. So we spent the morning in the archives. And as we were getting ready to go, one of the librarians came in. Now, I knew that the Clementses were from the north. They were in County Antrim. But I thought, well, you know, it hasn't always been two countries. So I thought I would ask him a question about the Clementses. And when I did, he got this funny look on his face, and he said, Clements? Clements is not an Irish name. Where did you say they were from? I said, well, there are a lot of them in County Antrim. He said, oh, well, they're probably Scots. They're probably Mac Clements.
I was crushed. I'm not Irish. I went back to my hotel room that afternoon, and my husband tried to cheer me up. And so that night he said, let's go hear some music. You love Irish music. Okay. We asked our host at the B&B where we were staying for a place to go that the tourists didn't go. We wanted to go hear real people in a real session doing real Irish music. And so he sent us to this little place. He said, you know, it's just down the road, and you take a left, you can't miss it. We missed it three times. But we finally found it. It was a very unassuming-looking building. And he told my husband, who's quite tall, to make sure he ducked when he went in the door, otherwise he'd knock his head. And that was right. The ceilings were low. It was a concrete floor, just two rooms, a bar in the one room where you walked in, and then another room where there was a coal grate, and that was the heat for the whole place. And every so often the barman would come in and kind of poke the coal and add a little bit to heat the place. And there were two tables in that room, and one was filled with people, and the other was empty, and there was a sign on the wall that said, reserved for musicians. So we sat there, and we waited till 10:30, as they say, 10:30, and finally the first musician came in, and he was an older gentleman, and he had a fiddle case under his arm. Well, he sat down, and he opened up the case, and I said, well, that's a beautiful fiddle you have there. And he said, yes. He said, my father played the fiddle, and his grandfather, and my grandfather before him. This one here is from Italy. It's not quite a Stradivarius, but almost. I said, wow, that's very impressive. Do you have children? Do they play? He said, I have children. They're all musical, he said, but only my son plays the guitar. Does he like traditional music? I asked. Well, he's liking it more now, but of course when he was young, all he wanted to play was the rock and roll. I was really concerned about that. You know, they play so loud, so I put triple-paned glass in the windows of his bedroom. But one day I was in town and one of the neighbors said something about hearing him play. I went home and I said, son, how can this be? How can you play so loud that people can hear you through triple-paned glass? And he said, well, Dad, don't you know I always play with the windows open? Well, I laughed and he laughed too. I said, your accent's a little bit different. Are you from around here? And he said, oh, no, I'm from Scotland. I said, oh. He said, I came here 3 years ago when I found out my wife had the cancer. This is where she was from, and I knew that she'd want to be home at the end of her life. This is where she's buried. After she died, I started coming here to the pub with my fiddle, and, well, there's some other boys that's coming. There's one old guy who comes in, and his daddy is 94. He always puts a penny whistle in his mouth. He doesn't get any sound out of it, but every so often he'll sing, and he's 94, but his voice is still sweet. And there's a few other fellows, play button accordion and banjo and the like. As he spoke, some of the other fellows began to come in, and I knew that our time together was probably about up. And I said, so tell me, what's it like being a Scotsman living here in Ireland? I guess I had some idea that Scottish people and Irish people wouldn't get along. But he looked at me so puzzled, and he said, well, I'm always honest. I'm always sincere, and anywhere I go, I'm myself. So I have decided that from now on, when someone asks me where I'm from, I will say, I'm not from anywhere, but anywhere I go, I'm myself.
Wonderful story, Denise. Tell me a little bit about what it takes to develop a story like that? Did you write it out?
That one I began to develop in a workshop that I went to. And I really had, I kind of had the end. You know, I remembered, his name was Mr. Hamilton, Tom Hamilton. And I remembered what a wonderful experience it was to talk to him. And when he said this, I didn't make that up. He really said this beautiful thing. And I'm always honest. I'm always sincere. Anywhere I go, I'm myself. I thought, wow. But I didn't think about it until a couple of months later. And I was thinking about the trip to Ireland and, you know, what I had gotten out of that trip. And of course, I had gone thinking that, oh, I'm Irish. I'm going to find out about my heritage. And then, of course, finding out that my great-great-grandfather was not probably Irish. I don't know where he was born, actually. I did a little internet searching, I still don't know where he was born.
Do most of the stories that you tell come out of your life, or do you use a lot of material that we might be familiar with but have read rather than heard?
I'd say it's about half and half. I think stories from your own life are a little more difficult in some ways because it's hard to know what to leave in and what to take out. With that story, I took out the part about going back to the hotel room and looking on the internet and finding out that Robert Clemens probably wasn't born in Ireland. It slowed the story down, so I took that part out. And some of the events happened in a slightly different order. So when I started working on the story, I had a much longer introduction of imagining myself at a cocktail party and this whole long scenario to finally get to this piece where I go to Ireland. And I realized that needed to be cut much shorter. So I used to write down all my stories, but I found the more I tell stories, the more I find that it's easier to develop them by just telling them to a good listener. And I'm so fortunate. I have other friends who are storytellers who just have such a great ear for what belongs and what needs to be in the story to help it move along. So I really work with them, and we take turns listening to each other. Most of them live up in Maryland, so we work on the phone. So that's the process. With a folk tale, it's a little different because I don't want to ever tell somebody else's version of a folk tale. There are certain elements that I like sometimes when I hear somebody tell it, but I always want to take the story in and let it kind of be inside and it'll change over time. I mean, I certainly have learned stories and told them the next day because the situation came up that I needed to do that. But I find the more I tell a story, the more it becomes mine, the more it becomes part of me.
Tell us a little bit about your one-woman show, The Heart's True Scale.
The Heart's True Scale actually came out of a workshop again. There's something about these workshops that I've done with my coach, Doug Lipman, who's such a nurturing presence. And in this particular workshop, what happened was we each had like a 45-minute turn each day, and then the last day you had a shorter turn. And that night, or that morning when I woke up, I had this character in my head, this tall, skinny, red-haired minstrel, had a harp on his shoulder. And I began to journal, and he began to tell me his story. And there was even a little song that came at the beginning. And that was the first part of the story. And I went to the workshop that day, and I told what I had, and everybody said, oh, you can't stop there. We want to know what happened next. And so over the next 4 years, it's a full-length piece. It runs about an hour and a half. It's a personal fairy tale. It is, or I call it a fairy tale for adults. It certainly has fairy tale elements.
Now, you've done this one-woman show around Richmond.
I have.
Several times.
I have.
Could you give us just a tiny sample from it?
Oh, sure. Let's see. So the very beginning starts, so I play the harp with it. That was the other thing that happened was when this character showed up, I knew that I wanted to play the harp, but then when he showed up in my imagination, I thought, well, this is a sign. And my sweet husband that year surprised me with my first little harp on my 45th birthday. So harping is part of it, definitely part of it, but I'll do this without the harp since I don't have it here. Sing derry-do as you walk down the road. Sing derry-do in the morning. Sing derry-do when the road grows long and evening shadows are forming. Sing derry-do when friends are few. Sing derry-do when the darkness closes round you. Sing derry-do to the clear morning light when dawn chases off the last of the night. Sing derry-do to the clear running streams. Sing derry-do to the mountain. Sing derry-do to the whole wide earth, the stars in the sky beyond counting. Once upon a time, a minstrel was walking down the road. He was a tall, thin fellow with bright red hair, green eyes, and a longish nose. He was dressed in a much-patched green tunic. On one shoulder he carried a knapsack, and on the other his most prized possession, a harp. He was on his way to the next manor house in hope that he could charm the lady of the place into keeping him on for a while. It was the spring mud season, and his boots were already beginning to leak. His name was Ignatius Polycarp de Compville, but he preferred to be called Nate. He was the youngest son of a very minor noble, and as such would not inherit the family land and title. But his mother had great hopes for him, that he would become a priest, and for a while it looked good. Because music came naturally to him, he could play, sing the mass better than the parish priest. By the time he was 10. Ah, but alas, there were other things that came naturally as well. And when Nate was 15, he had fallen in love with the fair Matilda. He made up a song for her, and after he sang it to her, she made him in the hay. And after that, he decided that he was not cut out for the priesthood. But to escape his mother's wrath, he decided to leave home, and he begged Matilda to go with him. But alas, she had no intention of spending the rest of her life with the penniless youngest son of the local lord. She'd already set her eyes on a rich merchant's son. So with his heart in pieces, Nate left home. He traveled from place to place, singing for his supper, and often going hungry. But then one fine day he came into a prospering market town, and there in the middle of the square was a handsome widow, finely dressed, struggling to carry a number of packages. Nate walked up to her, he swept off his hat and bowed low. Ah, dear lady, pray allow me the great privilege of carrying your packages home for you. The widow was charmed by this speech, and so she invited him to come home with her. She gave him supper. He stayed for 6 months. He became her scribe. They found he had a real talent with his quill. But, alas, her older sons did not think much of their mother's new employee, and they invited him to leave. But before he left, she gave him a harp. And so he set forth into the world to begin his life as a traveling minstrel. If it had not been a life that had thus far brought him fortune and fame, at least it had never been dull. And that day would prove no different.
We're talking with Denise Bennett, who is a storyteller, and she has been telling a section from her one-woman show, The Heart's True Scale. Denise, you in this interview so far have talked about going to a lot of workshops, about having friends who are also storytellers that you can talk back and forth with and tell back and forth with. And then you also mentioned a coach. I think we're getting a few clues as to how someone learns to become a storyteller, but what kinds of things did you have to do, and how long have you been telling stories?
I started telling professionally in 1996 when I was in seminary. And I don't know that it's necessary to go to a lot of workshops or to work with a coach, but it certainly has helped me to deepen my understanding and my love of storytelling and to improve as an artist.
Is it hard to find an audience?
I think the biggest challenge is for people to understand what storytelling is. I think I've had a lot of people say, well, you read books to kids? No, I learn the stories and I tell them by heart. Actually, there's a beautiful Scottish traveler's proverb that says a story is told eye to eye and heart to heart. I think that's so beautiful.
But it's more than entertainment.
For me, it certainly is. I mean, there are certainly stories that are just fun. So certainly there are stories that are told for entertainment, and there's nothing wrong with that because, you know, life is full of hard stuff. And so it's wonderful to be able to go and hear a story that just makes you laugh. That's medicine. That's healing. So there's nothing wrong with stories that are just entertaining at all, and I tell some stories like that as well. But for me, I find myself gravitating towards stories that have a deeper, fuller meaning.
I noticed on your website that one of the favorite things that has been said about you was said by a master storyteller, Elizabeth Ellis. She said, Denise Bennett is a storyteller and a musician of exceptional talent. Her work is timeless and flawless. Her work reminds us of the love that dwells in the deep heart's core. Is that a favorite quote because, or is that a favorite quotation because that's what you're trying to do, dwell in the deep heart's core?
It is, and it's also, Elizabeth is such a master storyteller too that she would say something, so I asked her for a quote because I've worked with her a number of times as she's been one of my teachers, and I was so blown away by that quote, but it is true. It is what I really want to do with stories. Somebody recently asked me, why do you tell stories? And I said, I tell stories because I want to find my way to that place where I disappear, the audience disappears, and we're just there experiencing the story. And it's like Holy Communion. There's just a moment sometimes in a story where I can feel this sort of opening in my, almost a physical opening in my body, and the audience. I can feel the audience opening too. And you can just look at them and know that we're in this beautiful moment.
About how many stories do you have in your repertoire?
Gosh, I really don't know.
Hundreds?
I don't think I have hundreds. I don't know, maybe 100? Maybe 75. I don't know. Sometimes I don't tell them for a while, and so I have a file, and I have to go back and kind of brush them up and say, okay, what happened after that happened? Oh, yeah, that's right.
Are you always working on developing a new story?
Yes, yes. I have a show coming up I'm sharing with another wonderful storyteller.
What is that? Tell us about
that.
Well,
a couple of things, actually. The Telltale Hearts, which is a local storytelling group that I'm part of, is telling at Temple Orami on December 5th.
Right.
Stories of Light. And
now, what is that show? Tell
that'll
me about
be
that.
Jewish stories, Hanukkah stories. We have the guest. We have a guest for that, which is their educator there at the temple. And but we'll be telling some funny stories, some deeper stories. So that's going to be, but focusing on Jewish stories for that evening.
Now, is that open to the public?
It
or is
certainly
that?
Is. It's open to the public. So you can they can go to telltalehearts.org and find out more information about that. And then in January 9th, I will be sharing the stage with Anthony Bircher, who is a local storyteller from New Kent County. And Anthony is really funny, and so we'll be sharing the evening. He'll be telling, I'm not sure how we're doing it yet, if he's telling half and I'm telling half, or if we're going to switch back and forth, but I think it'll be a great evening. That's January 9th at the Glen Allen Cultural Arts Center.
Okay, great. Well, we can check the website to find out
exactly,
more about
yes.
that. Great.
Yes.
You mentioned the Telltale Hearts. Tell us a little bit about that organization.
Well, we're a group. We celebrated our 10th anniversary last year, and we're a group of people who love to tell stories, primarily to adult audiences. So that was, I alluded to that before, how it can be difficult for people to understand what storytelling is. They may think it's just for children or... that's probably the most common misconception. They may not understand that it's an art form, and so that's part of our mission is to bring storytelling to adults in the Richmond area. Actually, we do have an open mic, and it's the second Tuesday of every month. We've been lately doing that at Elwood's Coffee and Tea in the Fan,
mm-hmm.
and we've done it in other places around the area as well.
You said that you used your stories as part of your pastoral work. Could you tell us a story from that genre?
Sure. Well, actually, I do use the same kinds of stories that I use in when I tell folk tales. In fact, I'll tell you one that I just told at a church. A couple of weeks ago, they had a sort of an older adults dinner, and I was the entertainment. So, this is a Haitian fairy tale or folk tale, and it's from a collection by Diane Wolkstein is the editor of the collection. The collection's called The Magic Orange Tree. But I also heard Elizabeth Ellis, who we referred to a few minutes ago, tell this story, and so this is my take on it, and it's called One My Darling. Once upon a time, there was a woman who had four daughters. Three of them she loved, and then there was the other daughter, Philomandre. Every morning, the woman would get up, and she would wash her hair and get ready to go, and then Philomandre would take the comb and comb her hair. The woman was really tender-headed, and only Philomandre had a touch that was gentle enough to get the tangles out of her hair. After she'd combed her hair, she'd braid it, and then the woman would go into town, and she would buy food. And she would come back to the house, and she had a little game that she played with her three daughters that she loved. She would stand outside the door, and she would sing this song. One, my darling, come to mama. Two, my darling, come to mama. Three, my darling, come to mama. But Philomandre, you stay. You stay right where you are. And the three girls that she loved ran out, and they went back into the house with their mama. They went into the kitchen. They fixed all this food, and they sat down and ate this wonderful meal, and if there was anything left over, Philomandre got that. Well, after a while, those three girls grew plump, and Philomandre just stayed kind of skinny. Now, there was someone who was watching this every day. It was a monster who lived in the woods, and there was nothing he liked better than plump young girls. So one day, after the mother had gone to the marketplace, the monster stepped out of the woods, and he began to sing the little song.
One, my darling, come to mama. Two, my darling, come to mama. Three, my darling, come to mama. And Philomandre, you stay. You stay right where you are.
Well, when the girls heard that, they said, that is not our mama. And they did not go outside. The monster realized the problem, so he went to the little elves that lived in the woods, and he said,
my voice is too low. Tune it up.
And so the little elves did whatever it is they do, and they tightened his vocal cords. And so the next day, after the mother had gone to the marketplace, the monster stepped out, and he began to sing the little song again.
One, my darling, come to mama. Two, my darling, come to mama. Three, my darling, come to mama. But Philomandre, you stay. You stay right where you are.
Well, of course, when the girls heard that, they said, that is not our mama. And they did not go outside. So the monster went back to the elves and said,
you've tuned them too tight. Loosen them up a little bit.
So the next day, when the monster came out of the woods, he opened his mouth and he began to sing. One, my darling, come to mama. Two, my darling, come to mama. Three, my darling, come to mama. Philomandre, you stay. You stay right where you are. When the three girls heard that, they thought it was their mother. They ran out and that monster grabbed them and carried them off into the woods. Now, when the mother came home, she stood outside the door. She sang the song, but the girls didn't come out. She sang the song again, but still they didn't come out. She went in the house. She saw Philomandre there. She said, where are your sisters? Philomandre said, Well, they went out when you sang about an hour ago. I wasn't here an hour ago. Where are your sisters? And she shook her. I don't know, Philomandre said. I don't know. And the mother turned and she went out the door. And Philomandre sat down to wait. She waited. And she waited. Her mother did not come back. And after day had turned to night and night had turned to day again and again, Philomandre combed her own hair and braided it and went into town. She went to the marketplace and she went to all the women who worked there and asked them if they needed somebody to do odd jobs for them. She needed to work so she could eat. And the women in the marketplace took pity on her, and they gave her things to do, and in return, they fed her. Well, a few months went by, and the king and the queen came into the marketplace, and they saw all the other little girls playing, but they saw one little girl who was working very hard. The queen got out of the carriage, and she went over to Philomandre, and she said, little girl, why are you working when all the other little girls are playing? Where's your mama? Where's your papa? And Philomandre said, I don't have a mama or a papa, and I work so I can eat. The queen went back to the king, and she said a few words, and then she came back to Philomandre, and she said, little girl, we don't have a daughter. Would you like to come back to the palace and be our little girl? Well, I don't have to tell you what she said, do I? So Philomandre became their daughter, and when the king and the queen passed away, she became the queen of that land. She was a very good queen. Whenever beggars would come to the palace door, she would tell her servants to bring them in, give them warm clothes to wear and something to eat and whatever else they needed, and send them on their way. One day, one of her servants came running into the throne room and said, Your Majesty, there's a beggar outside the door. And Philomandre said, well, you know what to do. Bring her in or give her or him whatever she needs. But Your Majesty, she's so strange. She's an old woman, and there are leaves and sticks in her hair, and there's a crazy look in her eyes, and she keeps singing this song. One, my darling, come to mama. Two, my darling, come to mama. Philomandre held up her hand. Bring her inside. Wash her up and give her something to eat. And the servant said, yes, your majesty. And she went out the door, and Philomandre sat on her throne and looked out the window. A few minutes later, she could hear screaming coming from down the hall, and the servant ran in. She was all wet, and there were scratches on her face. He said, your majesty, that old woman's crazy. I tried to comb her hair, and she attacked me like an animal. Philomandre said, give me the comb. She walked down the hall. She opened the door, and she stood behind her mama. She began to comb her hair and to sing. One, my darling, come to mama. Two, my darling, come to mama. Three, my darling, come to mama. But mama, you stay. You stay right here with Philomandre.
What a beautiful story.
Yeah, I love that story.
Do you use that story in a pastoral setting?
I use it, I've used it to talk about forgiveness. In fact, and I've used it, I used it not long ago with a, I was part of a seminar on forgiveness that was presented to chaplains and hospice workers in conjunction with a professor whose name escapes me right at the moment from VCU, who's done a lot of research on forgiveness and what constitutes forgiveness. So I told that story, and then we talked about, well, did Philomandre forgive her mother? Did what leads you to believe that? What do you think she was thinking about? You know, all those questions. But I just think it's such a beautiful story about forgiveness, and because it is my opinion that she's forgiven her mother.
And it is a story that helps illustrate, I think, one more of the uses of story as entertainment, as teaching, as a jumping-off point for exploring.
Yeah, I think what a story does, that I can stand up and lecture about forgiveness, but I think it's so much more powerful to tell a story that really takes us into that emotional moment or moments. And plus, that story is not real familiar, so we don't really know, we're not sure what's going to happen next. And so I think sometimes when people hear somebody lecture, they kind of go on automatic pilot, or you think, oh, I know where this is going. But when you hear a story and you don't know where it's going, I think it opens one up to a deeper, a level of understanding that's not just intellectual.
And holds the interest, I can
yes,
tell you that.
Yes, and holds the interest, yes.
Earlier too. You said that that your undergraduate degree was actually in drama theater?
Yes, that's right.
What was the transition? Tell us the story about Denise Bennett now. The transition from theater major to seminary student.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a long story. But I went to Richmond Hill. Richmond Hill, the ecumenical retreat center here in
Churchill.
Richmond, uh-huh. In Churchill, right. And, it goes back further than that. When I was a little girl, I always said I wanted to be a writer and a minister. And I wanted to be a minister because we had this wonderful, the first woman pastor I'd ever seen. She was the associate minister at the church we went to at the time. And she was just so beautiful and articulate. And, of course, I wanted to be her. But then I didn't really think about that. I went to, as an undergraduate, to Birmingham Southern College, and I had a full tuition scholarship in theater, and which that and a
$1.50 will buy you a nice cup of coffee from Starbucks. And so then I went to graduate school for theater, and I also met my husband there in New York, and got married, and did what a lot of artistic people do. I sort of, you know, flopped around and for a while and worked as a waitress, and then I had my children. And
but it was your intention then to go on the stage, or?
I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I really did. My 20s, I just really didn't know what it was that I wanted to do. So there were a couple of different things that happened. I went to a great writing class with Jeanette Drake, who's a local poet and writer and artist. And that was when I think I was pregnant with my second child. And I remember doing this writing exercise, and then we read out loud afterwards, and she said, I said, I feel so excited. And she said, I think you should be excited. So that was the, and it really, as I think about it now, it was a personal story about something that had happened, just a snippet. And so that was a seed. But then I also went to the Rua School of Spiritual Guidance while at Richmond Hill. And it was just a great program. I met such beautiful people there and learned so much and really felt called to go to seminary. And so I did that. And it was a great experience. I had wonderful, wonderful professors there who, if they didn't always have the most creative curriculum, they're such a good school academically. I felt like I really got my, with the biblical languages and the theology and pastoral care, it's just a really good, solid theological education.
And we're talking now about Union Theological Seminary here in Richmond.
But also I had teachers who were really encouraging of my using my creativity. I had one professor who allowed me for my reflection papers in Old Testament to write poetry. I had another professor for a liturgy class who I wrote songs. I wrote settings, my own settings of psalms. And so I got a lot of encouragement to be creative and to use my creativity. And it was in that environment that I began to tell Bible stories. It's like, well, duh. Yeah, you know, these are great stories to tell. They're so dramatic and of course, convey our faith.
Since seminary, what have you done in addition to the storytelling? You said that now you are the chaplain at the Hermitage.
I work part-time as a chaplain at the Hermitage, and I've actually been there since 2000. So that's really what I did right after I got out of seminary. I graduated in 99, and then I started working there in 2000.
Okay, and you have pursued storytelling and developed your own one-woman show,
yes,
which you've given,
yes,
and also joined the Telltale Hearts, whom you will be performing with on December 5th at Congregation
Orami.
Yes. And on January 9th, the Midwinter Warm Up.
And Get Down, we added that.
And that will be at the Cultural Arts Center at Glen Allen. Great.
Yes.
We have just a few minutes, about 10 minutes left. Would you share one more story with us?
Well, let me tell you one more personal story, and this is called My Grandmother's Garden. My grandmother's yard was the garden spot of Flora, Indiana. She had such amazing flowers. There were black-eyed Susans and tiger lilies that prowled under the maple tree. There were day lilies, yellow and orange. There were snapdragons, rambling roses. There were hollyhocks that grew in the back, and I used to love to pluck a hollyhock blossom off, and I'd turn it upside down and pretend it was a little ballet dancer. And back there with the rhubarb, there were the sunflowers that looked down at me with their big, dark faces. And over by the fence were the purpley-blue hydrangeas and those big white ones that my grandma called snowballs.
And I used to trail around behind my grandmother, and I'd ask her the names of the flowers. What are those big pink ones again? Those are peonies. Now, you may say peonies, but my grandmother was from Indiana, and she said peonies. Those are peonies. Oh, and she had spring flowers, too, of course. There were hyacinths and daffodils and crocuses that came up through the snow. But my favorite of all the flowers were the iris that came up in Indiana in early June. I used to love looking in that secret chamber that the top petals of an iris make. You kind of look inside, and there's this delicate perfume that would just waft up like incense to heaven. Now, it was in my grandmother's garden that I learned a lot of things. I learned about sex and death. This is still a G-rated story, however. See, my grandmother, in addition to being a wonderful gardener, was also a soft touch. And so my grandfather was a butcher. He owned a meat market. And so he would bring home all the stuff that he couldn't sell, the trimmings and the kidneys, things like that. And my grandmother would take all that stuff. She'd chop it up, mix it with table scraps, and put it out as a smorgasbord for all the stray cats in Flora, Indiana. And where there are stray cats, there is stray cat romance. And so I can remember lying on the Davenport and on a summer night with the window open and listening to the cats singing their arias of passion. And of course, 8 weeks later, there would be kittens. And so my grandmother would tell my brother and I, "Now, if you don't get up and chase them, they'll come to you. Just sit on the back porch, sit real still." So my brother and I would sit there really still, and we'd wait until one of those little kittens would poke their heads out from the tiger lilies, and sometimes they'd even let us pet them. Now, one summer when I was 12, my cousin Bobby was there visiting with his family from the West Coast. Bobby was 2 years older than I was. He was a bad boy. He had long hair. He smoked. He cussed. He was a bad boy, and he thrilled me to my core. But Bobby was a soft touch like the rest of the family. And so one day we were out in the yard, and Bobby said, "Hey, come here, look at this." And he pointed, and down there amongst the daylilies, there was a nest of kittens. They were really small, and I said, "Where's the mother cat? Shouldn't the mother cat be with them when they're that little?" And he said, "Yeah. We watched all day, and we didn't see the mother cat come back. We went to my grandmother, and we told her, and we said, you know, we need to do something. We need to get some formula or something to feed them." And my grandmother said, "Honey, if the cat hasn't come back, if the mama cat hasn't come back, there's probably something wrong with those kittens." "Oh, please, Grandma, please." So finally she consented, and my grandpa went and got some kitten formula from Doc Shipsides, who was the town vet. And Bobby and I took turns feeding the kittens. My grandma was right. There was something wrong with those kittens, I guess, because when Bobby and I got up in the middle of the night to feed them, they were all gone. And I don't know who cried more, me or Bobby. When I got to be a teenager myself, my grandmother's garden was where I went for refuge from those people in that house that I was not going to grow up to be like. I can remember one summer day I was so bored, and my grandmother and my grandfather, who was now retired, and my mother were all sitting there on the couch watching their stories. I sat down on the couch, and I looked at the screen, and I said, "Wait a minute. I thought that guy was dead. I used to watch the stories every so often with my mother." And my grandmother said, "Oh, no, no. Everybody thought that. But actually, he went to another town, and he was in an accident. And he had amnesia. And while he was having amnesia, he fell in love with another woman. But now he's back, and that evil Erica is going to blackmail him." And I rolled my eyes and I stood up. I can't believe you guys watch this stuff. And my mother said,
shh, Heather's about to tell him about the baby.
I went outside. And what I usually did when I was a teenager out in my grandmother's garden was I made up stories or I made up songs. Usually really wretched love songs for whichever boy was ignoring me the most. Here's an example. I want you, take off your laughing mask and show me the man who's buried deep inside. 'Cause I can hear him yelling, screaming, let me out, let me out. I've got to breathe. All of that for a 15-year-old kid with pimples. I grew up, eventually, and I went to college. I got married. I had two boys of my own. My grandparents, my grandfather died, and my grandmother moved to a nursing home. And my parents had to sell the house. Now, the adult part of me understood that. My grandmother needed the money to live on, but that child that was still inside me said, no, you can't sell that house. You can't sell the garden. All my best childhood memories are there. And of course, they had to. Well, my grandmother turned 90. I took my boys and we went with my parents back to Indiana to have a big party for my grandma at the nursing home. And it was wonderful. All these relatives came that we hadn't seen in forever, and my grandmother had a wonderful time. And at the end of the party, my mom said, do you want to go and see the house? I heard from Cousin Beverly that the people who bought it have really fixed it up, and I'd like to see it. Sure, I said. So we drove over. We parked in front of the house, and Beverly was right. The house looked great. They'd put siding on it. The front porch, which had been starting to sag, was no longer sagging. They'd even put siding on the old cinder block garage. But when we looked at the yard, everything was gone. Even the maple tree, they had covered everything with pea gravel. I couldn't believe it. My mother and I just sat there with our mouths hanging open, and finally my mother said, well, I guess it's a good thing I did what I did. I said, what are you talking about? I felt kind of guilty about it at the time. What did you do, Mom? Before we sold the house, I dug everything up. I dug up the peonies. I dug up the hydrangeas. I dug up all the iris. They are in a box in my garage. Would you like some? So now, every spring, my grandmother's iris bloom in my yard. I am not the gardener my grandmother was, but fortunately for me, iris proliferate like stray cats. And so now on a spring morning, I go out and I peek into that secret chamber that the upper petals of the iris make and smell that delicate perfume that wafts like incense to heaven. And it's almost like being back in my grandmother's garden again.
Thank you, Denise Bennett. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.